Act, session number 30285. Yes.
John Dixon, reel 4.
Yeah. So, I was anticipating really being posted to an operational conversion unit within Bomb Command, based a lot on the fact that we were ignorant about what Coastal Command did and how you got there. We just took it for granted that the 1,000 bomber raids had been on in that year, and we were aware of the losses and all this sort of thing. So when the Sherman took it for granted, we'd be moving along the conveyor belt into that system. So I was absolutely puzzled when my posting notice came, because instead of being posted to a Bomber Command OTU or some flying unit, they told me that I was being posted to London. And I thought, well, what the heck has London got to do with training air crew? The fact of the matter was, I had been selected for radar training after completion of my air gunners course, and of course, bereft of any knowledge at all of radar or anything to do with that, they told me I was being sent to London to do a course. So there I appeared in London at the Science Museum there, where my posting notice said I was to do the ground aspect of a training course, the physics and the theories and a course. And I thought, well, I'm lost. So when I went there, found where they were, that there was a guard on the place, and I was allowed in. And then I discovered it was the ground training school for the number 3 radar school, and that I'd been sent there to be taught the theory and practice of handling airborne radars.
Had there been any factors, do you think, in your earlier training that might have led you to being selected for radar?
Well, I discovered that later on, the fact that many of the air crews who did the air weren't cherry-picked and were sent to undertake radar training. And I'd done very well. I think I was second on the air gunner's course. And I think that's why they sent me there. Can't think of any other reason. But I did read post-war that the people were in fact cherry-picked to go on some of these specialist courses. So I suppose that's what happened. And there in London, they taught us the theory of radar.
Can you give me some idea of what that level of instruction and teaching was at that kind of basic level of radar that you were being instructed on?
Not easy, I'm afraid, and I've no documents. I remember we were taught some physics and maths, and we were taught about the theory of radar and what it did and what it couldn't do and the various aspects of the equipment. We didn't actually, I don't think we handled any equipment. It was a purely theoretical training course to provide us with a basic understanding of what the equipment was that we were going to use.
And had you any previous knowledge? Because I know, obviously, when you were at Tangmere, you weren't aware of radar at that stage. Had, in the intervening period, had you any awareness that radar existed?
No, it was still terribly, terribly, terribly hush-hush. No one had any idea that there was airborne radar. I think we were the first nation, weren't we, to install airborne radar in our aircraft. So it was little wonder that we didn't know anything about it.
Was there an element of security attached to attending this course?
Yes. There was a physical security, because they had some policemen controlling the building, and you couldn't get in there. So that hush-hush. And then I'd completed that aspect of the course, but I discovered later that, for reasons I can't remember, the course had been split, and the theoretical side had been placed in London, but the unit was number 3 radar direction, they said, school, but the airborne side of it was being carried out at Prestwick. So the next thing I know, I got a posting notice telling me to report to Prestwick. And I thought, what the heck am I going to Prestwick for? Well, no, little did I know, but that's where the aircraft were that was going to give us the airborne training aspect of it. And it was there that I met for the first time, and as it so happened, the last, the Blackburn Botha.
Tell me now about the Blackburn Botha as an aircraft.
Yes. Well, as I'm talking to you, I'm actually looking at a picture, and it's called, it's headed, the ill-fated Botha. It's, as you probably know, it was a frontline aircraft in 1939 with Coastal Command, supposed to be a replacement aircraft for the Anson and so on. And when they got it into a squadron, it decided it was a very independent aircraft and would do the most unusual types of things whilst in flight, like deciding to do its own headings and wobbles, and they pushed things, and aircraft did the opposite of what was expected. For instance, when we were airborne, we were these aircraft, the pilot would tell us we've got to sit in the turret for takeoff because of some of the habits it had on takeoff, which were unpleasant. And they also discovered various things. You could switch things off, which you saw was off, in fact were on, so things would take place that were totally unexpected, and the casualty rate was a bit high. It's said that a certain squadron leader, and you may be aware of this, who was flying, I've been told to fly one of these things and test it, he was told that it's a very difficult aircraft to get into, and the squadron leader replied, they should have made it impossible. That aircraft, of course, was withdrawn very hurriedly from the front line. I don't think it lasted a matter of about 8 to 10 weeks, and was then put into training aircraft and appeared as, in fact, later on in Scotland as an aircraft training air gunners. And then it trained the radar operators. And they also used it for training GR navigators on flight. So they used it extensively, but it had acquired, by the time I got to it, a very bad reputation of what the things it got up to. So I remember it very well. But anyway, we had to use the aircraft for our airborne lessons and the use of the equipment.
What radar equipment were you training on?
I'm just coming to that very point, actually. This was not the Mark 1, the very early one, which was very unreliable. This was the Mark 2. And the Mark 2, of course, was the development of the Mark 1. Proved itself to be quite useful if people could use it properly. And it was used extensively amongst the operational aircraft of Coastal Command during the early days, certainly up to 1943. So that equipment was equipment that was used for seeking U-boats, convoys, and it also had a facility of providing us with signals from ground stations identifying themselves. So they had a navigational bearing as well as a reconnaissance one. It was fairly limited in what it could do, and it was very difficult, particularly if the seas were bad. You couldn't see through the sea return.
What are you actually looking at when you're looking at the radar?
If you can imagine a square, and up the centre of the square, vertically, is a bright line, which is known as the time-based line. If the signal that is sent out by the aircraft transmitter finds something solid, like a ship, it will reflect that signal back to you, and by doing so, it breaks up the time-based line. It blips and shows a signal either side. Depending where it is, the signal is to your port, then the signal strength will show up on the port side of this vertical line, vice versa, of course, on the other side. So if you're looking at it and searching with it, that's what you're going to see, a break in the time-based line as it picks up the signal. And it's limited in its distance, and it's governed also by height, what you're flying at. as to what range, but it was very limited, in fact, in the distances that you could expect to pick up a signal. But having said that, it proved to be quite effective within its limited ranges.
You say that the sea could affect the time-based line. Are there any other factors that could affect it?
Yes, the time-based line would also pick up other things, like maybe clouds, which would affect the time-based line, break it up, and start to distort the things. So the picture was never a very pretty one, of a nice, lovely, lit-up line, where you could say, good gracious me, there's something there. What you were seeing was a vibratory signal changing in intensity, perhaps, to an umbrella. If you're thrown about in the aircraft, it tends to shift itself around a bit. So you had to be conversant with the variations on the theme, and there's nothing you can do about it, really. And so that's what I was there to learn about. And according to my logbook, it took 10 hours and 15 minutes of flying time to complete the course. And that was on the infamous Botha.
Was it an easy skill, do you think, to pick up for you? Did you find it?
No, it wasn't easy. Some people could deal with it better than others. And we have to remember that it was a basic, early version of our airborne radars. And there were a lot of improvements that had to come, very, very significant ones, in fact, which changed theoretically and jokingly the picture of the developments. But in these early stages, it was not easy. Not easy. And you also have to recall that it would pick up the coastline, so you would get the time-based line breaking as the signals reflected from islands or bits of land that came up. So you had to have an understanding of interpreting what you were seeing. And it required some operating skills to be used effectively.
And what would the exercises, what form would these exercises take?
We flew out from Prestwick, and there's the Isle of Islay, isn't it, Islay? There was an island there. No, it wasn't an island. And we would use the small island as a target. So we would home around and sweep with the radar until we got a signal. Now, if we're coming from an island, it would be, if you got it, it would be a positive signal, so you could come in on it and handle it. So for learners, that's what we used to do. The instructor would be there, and we'd pick up a solid plane, would give a good return at the particular operating heights and ranges. And we would use that and then take the aircraft onto the target. But in those cases, of course, we didn't do any, I don't recall we did any actual operating work with the submarines. I remember the islands and shipping. What's that? That type of excitement. But I don't remember hunting new birds with it.
And
on the training course.
How would you move the direction of the radar? Would that be something that would control at all? Or would that be fixed on the aircraft?
These were primitive arrangements. They were governed by the aerial systems, which you may have seen. I'm sure you have the Yagi aerial systems, which you see protruding from the top of the aircraft. And you also saw, if you looked underneath the port and starboard wings, there would be forward aerials transmitting their signals out there, and the radar set aerials would be set up to pick up the signals coming back to you from the side of the aircraft on the forwards and so on.
So it's very much a matter of, in the early training days with the Botha, that it's where really the aircraft's pointing, is it?
That's right.
As to what you can see.
Yeah, that's right. They did have a time. Graduated distances on the thing, and then you could switch. So you could switch from short range, you could sweep at 5 miles range, And then you had another thing. If you wanted to, you could sweep it 15 miles range. So there was a variable factor which you could operate manually to produce those sort of things. But within the limitations of the equipment, you wanted to get as near as you could to the signal to make sure that you could hold it and do those sort of things. So that's really what we were doing up there. It was familiarization and knowing what the knobs were for and seeing the pictures that it was presenting. And one must recognize that in those early days, the operational squadrons of Coastal Command on reconnaissance and anti-U-boat did in fact use the equipment. And they used it very successfully in many cases. And many attacks were actually picked up by the operators using equipment. So even in its early stages, it was beneficial. Another interesting thing, I don't know how many people are aware of it, but after we got a much more sophisticated radar later on, which we can probably talk about, lo and behold, the same Mark II equipment reappeared on our Liberator. I said, well, this is very funny. We don't want a piece of kit like that. We've got all this lovely planned position indicator thing, which is very nice, very effective. And they told us that what we had to do with the Mark II radar now was from time to time we would be required to switch it on to see whether the German U-boats were using their transmitter to pick up our radar signals. They were already tuned in to the Mark II frequencies, not like the 10 centimeter later radar. And then they got those frequencies, and what they would do, and they did it quite successfully, they used their receivers to pick up the transmission signals from the aircraft. And so what we were told to do was we could check that by every now and again switching on the blue bottle, which was the dear old Mark II. And if we watched, we could see whether the U-boat was transmitting a signal or with his receiver. And that enabled us then to know that we were being monitored. But we weren't using the Mark II, but the Germans didn't know it, so they thought we were using it, so they kept searching for it, and they never found it. So they took the blue bottle eventually away. But it had a moment of glory like that, as we switched. But we were told you mustn't put it on very long. Just watch it, see if there's any signal, and switch it off. But from time to time, switch it on and see if there's somebody's monitoring you. And that was the dear old Mark II.
Given what you've said about the air gunnery training and not feeling that was quite satisfactory, how about this radar training? Did you feel that was satisfactory for you during that period?
But I think there's always an element of argument about how long a training course should be, what you can afford to do, waste in the time scale, do you need manpower quickly employed, and things like that. I suppose, like so many other things, you would get better if you had more time to train on the equipment. I think that goes without saying, doesn't it? And I think that would have applied certainly to. We could have gone on to stage another phase of the airborne training by sending us out into the Atlantic to where there were no British submarines patrolling for our purpose or doing something out there, maybe doing an exercise, but go out there and find it because there's one there. So use your equipment and see what you can do. That sort of thing. But that's expensive, it's time-consuming, and they would take it for granted when you got on the squadron. Those sort of things would have to be absorbed in. But the training doesn't stop, does it, when you go to the squadron? Far from it. It can become more intense. So in those circumstances, the continuation of the training is carried out at the squadron level. And so we can argue about whether the people going through were really highly trained as they should have been. But even that became a bit of business. I don't know whether this is the time to tell it, but when I actually joined my first squadron, there was no Mark II. All the Blinken aircraft were fitted with a receiver and transmitter, the like of which I'd never seen, being manufactured in America, known as the Mark V, and a brilliant piece of equipment, so superior in its use than the poor old Mark II, that you wouldn't believe it. But I was trained on the Mark II, and when they gave me this, they said, there's the Mark II. I said, what's that? So that was the result of the training.
What about operating from Prestwick? Were there any problems in operating from there, with it very obviously being Scotland? Or there?
I don't recall any at all. We stayed on the airfield, lived in a house there, and I don't remember having any problems with it. All I remember is that the pilot on one of the flights, or maybe more, told me to get into the turret and sit there until we were airborne.
Was that a matter of balance on the Bofa?
Something like that. There was a whole variety of problems. That was one of them. Gyrations would tend to drift off into things. So the pilots wouldn't take off without putting somebody in the turret.
Were you aware of the problems with the Bofa at that time?
No. I never heard of the aircraft. And I can understand why.
So what was the next stage for you? Where did you go to next?
Well, now all is revealed, because having completed the course there at Prestwick, we were then told that we were going to a place called Silloth, RAS Silloth, which we were told was located down in the Firth, from south of Prestwick. In other words, the Firth borders Dumfries, and so we didn't have far to go to find our way to the airfield. And in fact, it was the base of number one coastal operational training unit, and were equipped with the Hudson and the usual backup training aircraft, the Oxfords and Ansons. And it was there, of course, that we would be trained in an operational role for Coastal Command, and that we would also, of course, find our first crew there. So I arrived eventually to Silloth, and after bits of this and bits of that, I was crewed up with an American pilot and a Canadian navigator.
How is the crewing up process done? Were you allocated to a pilot?
In some areas and of the RAF, as people went into the octaves, they were crewed up. Some were crewed up, and I was subsequently later on in the squadron, given no option. I was just told to join the crew. But at the octave itself, my first crew, we were a voluntary arrangement. The other signaller was an old friend of mine who'd always trained with me, and so we came to the OTU together. And we decided that we'd join up with this American and the Canadian. And so that became our first crew.
What were the factors involved in you choosing them, your crew, your pilot?
Well, it's like everything else, I think. You know, personalities and chat. And the American was a somewhat quiet, serious-minded American. Not quite up to the normal standard that people think they have. And so but he was a nice chap, came from Michigan, and Canadian was a chap named Sosrinsky, some strange Polish descent, of course. And so we joined up as a crew voluntarily, and then underwent all the various aspects of the Coastal Command air crew training, primarily in a reconnaissance and bombing role. Silloth is a smallish town, located on the southern side of the Solway Firth. Not exactly like the West End, a little bit remote. And you get there by the train from Carlisle, and to the north of you lies the somewhat inspiring mountains of Scotland across the Firth. The day I arrived, it was in the late afternoon, and it was dark, cheerless, and of course a winter month in December, not very inspiring indeed. And as actually we went through the main gate and through the station, there was an almighty explosion, and we later discovered that a Hudson had crashed on landing, and that it had exploded. And that was none too encouraging. Initially, we were put in a hut where there were some survivors from previous crashes who were waiting there to be recrewed. So that wasn't terribly helpful either. But then later on, our course was put together, and off we went.
Yeah. Was the airfield a peacetime airfield that had been converted, or was it a wartime?
I believe it was a wartime air force completely. In fact, I have been back there post-war to see if I could bring back some memories, but in fact, they've redeveloped the whole site, and it was extremely difficult to find out where the airfield was, and we didn't even find the entrance to it. That's back to normal, I suppose, in those terms. Anyway, we were kept very busy there at Silloth. We did flying, of course, and various types. I started off flying as a wireless operator in the airspeed Oxford and doing some solo work. And then we went onto the Anson, did some later work. And during that period, when we'd completed that, we were cruder.
Was that a form of refresher that you were doing, really, on the Oxford and the Anson?
In some ways, yes. But of course, the aircraft had longer ranges and different equipment than we'd been previously used to having. In fact, one of the surprises when we went across to the Hudson was that they were fully equipped with American radio and BFN equipment, which we'd never even seen, never been trained on. So all the previous work that we'd done on the equipment was invalid. At least I suppose there was some gain. So we had to restart all over again and find out how to operate the American equipment.
Could I ask you what the weather conditions were like at Silloth?
Pretty poor. In fact, I can recall one or two nights when we were standing by in the ops room waiting for weather clearance before we could take off. Then one or two things indicate too how bad the weather up in that area was, really. We were doing a night sortie and navigation exercise, and the weather was certainly worse than after we were airborne. And to tell that we hadn't been airborne all up and on before, we discovered we didn't know where we were. And that caused some perturbation. And indeed, that aircraft, I recall, had the old wicked 1082, 1083 transmitter receiver on it, and that wasn't functioning either, so we couldn't contact anybody. And I still remember sitting on the floor with a pile of parts of the radio, which I was trying to sort out what was wrong. I never did find out. But then we saw a hole around the cloud there and went beneath it. And then, to our surprise, we saw an airfield. So we very promptly put flaps and wheels down and jumped in there. And they told us that the name of the place was Cark, which was a little airfield on the Cumbrian coast. So having sorted ourselves out and got some direction how to get back, we went airborne and went back to Silloth. But the interesting thing was that it was only a matter of some days later when we were airborne at night, and we got lost again. And there was all the concerns about that. As you know, the area is full of mountains down there in Cumbria. And anyway, we went through the clouds, and there were some lights down there, so we decided we might just run land and find out where we were. In fact, when we got down, unbelievable, but it was Cark again. So we were very grateful to Cork. And so